Hello, and thanks for listening to this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to our regular listeners. It's getting to be quite a crowd now, so I'd better speak up so those at the back can hear everything. I hope the new year has got off to a good start for you all. And as well, hello to those joining us for the first time. There's no need to dress up. Business casual is fine, even a onesie. We're not going to judge. And if there's something you need to share, get in touch. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address for any comments, ideas, or requests. This episode is about new starts, getting going, that tricky time when you begin a job in a new organization. How do you navigate that? The things you should do beforehand? Is there a honeymoon period? Those kinds of questions. We've got some great guides to that experience here to give the topic a thorough going over. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF. I've been here about 4 years, and for me, it was quite a jump to get to the ISF because my previous employer, I was there for almost 20 years. That was quite a shock. And we've got so the guests here, I think a more varied experience, starting with Lisa Burns-Peak, who has been a security leader in many different organizations. She's worked at Maersk, Marks & Spencer's, Royal Bank of Scotland, and is currently working with Smart DCC. On security and risk. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Mark. Nice to see you.
Yeah, great to have you here. One quick question. Is moving around something that people working in InfoSec have to get used to? It does seem that people have fairly short tenures here and there, or is every move a promotion?
I don't think necessarily it has to be a promotion. I do think moving around is a good thing. It gives you a lot more experience, gives you a lot of diverse experience in different organizations. Cyber itself is an awful lot of common sense, but actually the way it is applied and implemented across different organizations and different business units with different priorities is where it's really quite exciting to see where those priorities sit. So for me, I think it's an advantage to move around, although I am conscious I'm saying that after being at Maersk for nearly 8 years. So it depends on the opportunities you have internally as well.
Very true. Also here is Paul Watts, a distinguished ISF analyst and a regular on the podcast. Hello, Paul.
Hello, good to speak to you again, and hello, Lisa. Mark, I've just got something I wanted to... do you remember at the end of the last podcast we recorded, which was about research in 2024, you closed with a phrase. Can you remember what that phrase was?
FAB.
FAB. So I took it upon myself to... I wonder what that actually stands for. Did you know? Because I've done a little bit of background digging around.
But weirdly, about... a week later, I heard someone talk about that. Well, it comes from a TV show called Thunderbirds, and said what it was, and I did not know up until that point. So, do you want to tell the audience what you like?
Yeah, it was interesting. So, actually, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson kind of stumbled upon it as just something when they were having a writing session. And they just wanted a tagline that just kind of ended a conversation. And fab actually didn't mean anything. If anything, it just was a shortened word for the word fabulous, which was very popular in the 60s. The Beatles were called the Fab Four and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And what actually happened is it got unofficial meanings. So people generally saw it as it stood for fully acknowledged broadcast or Roger Roger or whatever you used to end the communication with. And as the Andersons went on, they continued to do this. So Stingray, which was Jerry Anderson's next series, they had PWOR, which was proceeding with orders received. And then Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, which was the one after that, was SIG, or Spectrum is Green.
Green.
So they continued that trend of those little acronyms at the end. And that's what FAB stood for. I just thought I'd share that with you because I was curious and it took me off in a very weird direction.
Yeah, I think it was fully apprised and briefed or something like that. I thought it was. But yeah, it was interesting that it came up. I don't know, Lisa, do you remember Thunderbirds, the Super Mario Nation?
So my children, when they were very young, really got into, there was a rerun of Stingray and there was a rerun of Thunderbirds on BBC Two, I think. And they got really into it because they were just the right age. So yeah, but I also think Spectrum is Green is a very good tagline for cyber, no?
Yeah. Should be, shouldn't it? Yeah, there's an awful lot of...
Seam is green.
Yeah. An awful lot of red, amber, green work that goes on, certainly.
I was going to say.
Exactly,
I would imagine it'd be more popular than Spectrum is red, I would imagine.
Yeah, though I suspect people see that quite a bit as well. But yeah, thinking about that sort of jobs and stuff like that, I mean, is the, I suppose the what is common across all those places, is that experience when you mentioned, Lisa, about people, the organizations doing InfoSec in different ways. And that is that something to look out for when you're starting a new job, I guess? Is there something you should do before you join the organization in the interviews or something? You get a sense of what they're like as an organization? I guess you should.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly speaking from personal experience, I think it depends what's important to you as an individual and what sparks your curiosity. And so if you have a general curiosity around what the organization you're interviewing with is trying to achieve, you know, what their strategy is, what they're trying to deliver, the challenges that they face, for me, that's a very appealing thing. And then being able to understand how that relates to either cyber or information security or technology and how they use technology. So it's definitely something to bring out in the interview, I think. But also, before you even get to that stage, a lot of the time, you know, there's no point interviewing with a company you're not interested in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, why would you? Yeah, but I did want to ask, though, because obviously there's a skill shortage out there. InfoSec folks and cyber folks are in massive demand. But I did wonder if that meant you can pick and choose. I don't know, Paul, if you have found that. Or is it, as you say, Lisa, find the places that you want to work rather than just work anywhere?
I think you have to have some sort of emotional investment in where it is that you work. Now, maybe that can be to a lesser extent if you're involved in a commodity function. But even in that situation, and I always said to my teams, it's so important to go out and learn the business and be curious and understand what it is that they're trying to do. You know, one of the biggest stigmas that cybersecurity professionals often face is that we're just getting in the way and we're being really obstructive. You know, I don't know anybody in cybersecurity who goes to work to be a pain in the backside. We're all trying to deliver value in the way that we know best through our tradecraft. But our tradecraft has to relate to what the organization is trying to do. So if you don't understand why a company exists and what it is it's trying to do, you are going to put yourself against the grain of the organization, and you're never going to really feel like you're contributing to that bigger picture. And I think that's really important in, you know, a long and successful tenure in a role.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. And also, from a personal perspective, if you feel so, for example, I worked for like a few years for Dunnhumby, who are the Tesco Clubcard data analytics company behind Tesco's Clubcard and others, not just Tesco's, but and others. And the reason that I was attracted to that role is because I was really interested in data. And it was kind of around the time of big data analytics. And the fact that this was a company that was absolutely focused on utilizing and being able to use data for, you know, specific uses was very interesting to me, certainly from an InfoSec perspective. And so it all does depend personally on where you want to grow yourself, I think, as well.
Right. But for both of you, have you been able to choose the roles you've taken on? It sounds like you did at Dunnhumby, Lisa. But other than that, is it a case of you don't quite get what you're given? But you know, how much choice can you exercise over where you go?
Personally, I feel that I've been extremely fortunate in being able to feel I was choosing, and so you know, I have kind of engaged with companies that I've found interesting, or I want to learn more about, or I feel that they can help grow me in a direction that I haven't been grown before. So I think I've been very fortunate in that respect.
I'm the same. I've been really, really blessed through my career where I have been able to choose to work with organizations that I found really, really interesting, but for a multitude of different reasons. But it absolutely gives you a sense of purpose, you know, from working in retail to working in banking and finance to working with critical infrastructure. You know, it's always been something that's interested me. And you know, similar to your engagement with Dunnhumby, I worked for a market research and analytics organization, which was a very diverse and absolutely fascinating role. And it's amazing. It really kind of hammers home the power and the value of data. And some of the things that they're getting up to are absolutely fascinating. But I have been lucky to have the freedom of choice, and not everybody is that lucky. So, you know, I do remind myself that I've been a very, very fortunate lad through my career.
But I don't know if you feel like you're the kind of people that would make it work anywhere, because I certainly feel like that with, you know, having done journalism in a few places, that I was interested in a lot of stuff and I could make it work. And there were better places and worse places to work. But, you know, and I stayed at my last employer, the Beep, for almost 20 years because it was great. You know, when it changed, the job changed a lot. But I wonder, you know, a lot of people in InfoSec are problem solvers, they're curious, they're interested, they're quite passionate often as well. So do you think you could make it anywhere, Lisa? Or is it not make it, sorry, make it work anywhere, that you would, even if you didn't, couldn't choose, you'd, you know, it's just the intrinsic fascination for the subject or just your personality that makes you make it work?
So I think it's a very personal thing, isn't it? So I have had roles where I have joined and thought, no, this is not for me. I can't add the value that I want to in this role.
Wow.
And again, I can't count myself as quite fortunate of being in a position to be able to walk away from those. And I am a big believer, and I know not everybody is in that position, but I have had roles, not many, but I have had roles where you join and actually the culture is not what you thought it was as part of the interview process. Actually, you don't feel as though you're adding the value that you were hoping and expecting to be able to add while you were in role. And I do think it takes, it's a combination of things, isn't it? It's personal circumstances. Or do you have the ability to be able to say, thank you, but this is not for me, and be able to walk away from that? And that's really usually down to financial situation and, you know, etc., what stage you're at your career, all of those kind of things. I've been very fortunate that my only experience with those have happened quite late on, so I've been in a slightly better position. Because I'm a big believer in, if you are not, if you feel unfulfilled at work, it's not probably the right place because you're not giving your best. And it's kind of a two-way contract, isn't it, with organizations?
I think that's right. I think there is that. I think people forget how important work is to them as people and their self-worth. Because my wife's been through a few reorganizations at some very large companies. They sometimes treat people terribly, and I think the worst thing they do is forget how the psychological impact of it as well, because it absolutely cuts people to the core.
It's
very true. In the leadership series that we've been working on over the last year or so, one of the things that has really, really come out is the relationship between the cultural context of the organization and the ability of the security leader, and this goes right down into the security organization, their ability to affect change. And our motivations are, you know, for some people, and, you know, Lisa makes the point really, really well, in some situations we're compelled to work wherever we can find the work because our financial circumstances dictate that we have to do that. If you have the luxury and the freedom of choice, your hierarchy of needs and your motivations change, and you've got to be invested in what the organization's got to do, and you've got to be able to live in and enjoy that culture. If the culture is at conflict with you and you have the propensity and ability to move roles, generally you will do so. And I think a lot of that reflects back into the average tenure of security leaders, which is still sitting between the sort of 2 to 4 years. There are some regional variations. That hasn't moved in a long, long time. And when you scrape the surface of that, and I talk to security leaders, what it largely comes down to is they just know they can't make the changes that they want to do. And, you know, they'd rather take their motivations and their passion elsewhere and find an organization where they can deliver real change and real benefit. And it just really hammers home something that I've learned over the years with everybody I work with in cybersecurity. They are so passionate and they're so driven to do the right thing. Their values are so important to them. And that is something that really I would encourage employers to be tapping into. And a lot don't.
Yeah, I think there's a real resource there, because the work I did on governance, there was quite a few interviews that were really quite difficult because people had hit that wall. They just, you know, they'd gone so far, and governance was supposedly quite important to that organization, and yet they weren't acting upon it. It was definitely a tick box. Yeah, we're doing governance, aren't we? Because this one person was taking care of it, rather than it sort of informing the whole organization and, you know, encouraging good cultures and things like that.
I think the problem with if your organizational strategy for security is just to tick the box, then you're never going to affect that cultural change. And it's always going to have you in a reactionary firefighting mode. And as we know, as the security industry is starting to knit itself more and more into business, we are on the hook for delivering value beyond fighting fires. The problem is you get in a terrible catch-22. If you can't have the business kind of running alongside you and pulling their weight, it doesn't free the teams to innovate and to try different things and to enrich the value that they bring to an organization. And you just get stuck in that rut. And nobody wants to be stuck in that rut. They want to be taking it to the next level. They want to be continuously improving. If you can never get off kind of stage 2 or stage 3 in the maturity cycle, that frustrates people who are motivated and driven to effect real change in their organizations.
Totally agree. Do you think that we've taken a step backwards within the security community in that respect, in being seen as business enablers and partners, as opposed to, I mean, I'm just minded of, you know, when I was working at Maersk under Adam Banks, who was a CTO and became the CTO in the end, before he left Maersk, he was very passionate about the idea that technology and the business were the same thing. They're not separate. We're not a mysterious part of the organization that is just, you know, spoken to when they want people on a new PC or they've got a new service they want to hook up and they can't because, yeah, you know, pesky firewalls don't allow, or, you know, connectivity doesn't security say no, or any of those sorts of things. And he's very passionate about the fact that technology as an enabler for a business should be really considered as part of that business. And they made a huge amount of strides in that. Guys, do you think that we're still seeing that across a number of companies? That's a very individual kind of experience. Or do you think we're still back into the, you need to be super technical, then we just go and configure a firewall and let us do what we want?
I guess it slightly depends on the organization. I mean, there's some I've seen, Maersk, good example, but there are others, doing some work on AI machine learning, and that's obviously a transformative technology, but you're not going to make the most of it unless your organization really takes a lot of other things seriously as well. And I think, you know, some organizations do, and others are just like, let's get us some of this AI. It sounds good. Let's do that. But they really don't make the most of it because they don't understand it. And I think, yeah, I think there is, it, I think, again, yeah, slightly weasel words, it does depend on the organization. But yeah, Paul, I guess you must have had that. If someone's willing to let you, not play with it, but let you realize what it can do for the organization, then sure, it's going to be better.
Yeah, I think there's a decent relationship between, you know, how we are changing as a community of practice and the position that industry finds itself in right now. I think because of the various challenges we have with geopolitical uncertainty and yada, 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 and then coupled that with the need to be highly competitive, along comes a toy like AI, and I'll put toy in quotes because of course it's not, and you end up with a very back to front thing, which is, we got to use this to be competitive. And actually saying, well, no, actually, we need to understand the question first. And I think that's kind of what it comes back to. If the organization has got itself to a level of maturity, it's more about, how do I answer this question and answer this question well? And it's this idea that we then kind of shift left a lot of the conversations that we have about what's the balance between risk and reward. We can take as much risk or as little risk as we want, but we all need to understand the ramifications of turning that dial up to 11 and turning it back down to 1. And it's very quick for organizations to move back into a reactionary firefighting thing. And if that cycle persists, I agree with you, Lisa, it does tend to drive us back. And one of the biggest frustrations when I talk to our community is that ability to go down and put a fire out and then go back up to 40,000 foot. I used to suffer this all of the time, and some of it was on me as well, a bit of a control issue. It's like when you go down to, you know, 0 foot and you're in there amongst the weeds, you know, fighting fires and putting them out, that's kind of fun, you know, that's quite exciting. But you then have to remember that you should be up here, you know, outreaching and reminding the business that it's important to think about security in the DNA and of everything they do. And if you're not doing that and nobody else is doing that, the longer you're down at naught foot having fun in the sock, the less you're not. And then the dynamo, it starts to slow down again. And then you've got to pull yourself out of that and pedal faster and get the momentum going. And it's the problem, the challenge that security leaders have. You can't be everywhere all of the time. And you know, in a paper that I'm going to put out in the end of February, I talk a little bit about this. It's like, security leadership now is more than one person. You can't be that person that's in the SOC one day and in the boardroom the next. You've got to give yourself the right amount of bandwidth. And I think that's part of the problem, Lisa. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I do agree. I would have liked, probably, I would have liked to have seen AI being taken to businesses by the technology function around its enabling ability for that business, as opposed to the business telling tech or, you know, IT. And so that's why when I was obviously looking at all of the dialogue around AI, etc., that kind of struck me of the fact that we seemed to be a little bit on the back foot, potentially as a community. And I don't know whether that's controversial or not. I don't mean to be, but it felt as though we were reacting to something as opposed to taking it to saying we could do this with this new technology, but for us to enable that for us, we need to clean up our data lakes. We need to have a really good idea of where all our information is so that we get really clean searches and good answers to the questions that we want, that we might want to put into it. We need to think as a business, what questions do we want to ask? What is it that we're trying to achieve? What does the outcome potentially look like? Do you know what I mean? And I felt with a lot of the dialogue looking at it, it felt as though we were battling against it as opposed to saying, taking it to. Do you know what I mean? It didn't feel like we were on the front foot with that sort of stuff.
I agree with you, but what I would also say, and again, this may come across as a bit of a controversial point, when you work in technology and you work in security, we all know that going into the cloud isn't as simple as going into the cloud, and adopting AI isn't as simple as adopting AI. We know all the prerequisites and all the enablers and everything that needs to happen in the right order for that to happen well, safely, and to return some sort of benefit. And when you look at things like AI is a classic example. Mark's done a cracking bit of work on this in the past. If you've not read his paper on operational machine learning, I urge you to read it. The fundamental basics of that come back to a principle that we all know very, very well. And we've kind of been hearing about it in the United Kingdom recently with the Horizon scandal and the post office being thrust forward again. It's garbage in, garbage out. And it's the same with AI. So if you have a fundamental underlying issue with data quality and data governance, charging headlong into AI is probably going to amplify a problem you already have. Now, security practitioners kind of know that. I wonder whether that makes us hesitate a little bit to go charging into the boardroom going, we've got a great idea about using AI, because you know they're going to get excited. They're going to tell you to go away and do that. But what you then realize is you've set yourself up for maybe 18 months of pain to get everything in the right order for that to work and work well. Otherwise, you're going to fail anyway.
Yeah, I think the garbage as well can be the process. I mean, I think, you know, we can have the greatest data in the world, and if the organization is not set up to do good things, then your process is just going to produce bad answers to the wrong questions. I mean, that's a given as well.
I should correct something I just said there in terms of the post office. It wasn't really garbage in, garbage out. It was processing garbage that led to garbage coming out. Yeah, and it's a whole other conversation in terms of what's playing out at the moment. But I think hopefully you understand. I kind of get the sentiment I was trying to drive through there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think for me, it was just a wider thing of around, horizon scanning from a security perspective around emerging tech. If you could have thought of AI, you know, maybe we missed the chance, but thinking of AI, seems to have gone down this rabbit hole now, sorry. As an emerging...
Look what you've done.
As an emerging technology, could we have been as an industry more on the front foot of around, we can absolutely, this is on the horizon to prepare our organizations to be able to use it. You know, there's this thing coming board that, you know, if we can invest, we need to do some tidying up in our data lakes, we need to do some tidying up in our governance processes, and then we'll be able to, when it becomes more and more popular, we'll be able to fully understand the use and the advantages it would bring to the business. And that's where I kind of think, certainly, have we begun to kind of drop down into that comfort area that you were talking about, Paul, just as a as a great, again, maybe controversial, have we lost that strategic piece that we had made real gains in as a community?
I think workload plays a massive part on that.
Yeah,
I think market dynamics plays a massive part in that. And the complexity of trying to build a substantive business case when you haven't got enough time to even have your lunch is a massive challenge in itself. All of that said, I think there is certainly more pressure now on security leaders to be a lot more forward thinking, notwithstanding the challenges of finding the time to do that. I mean, the ISF takes that really, really seriously. And Mark, you know as well as I do, the effort and energy that we put into cultivating and enhancing Threat Horizon, as one example, to be saying, look, this stuff is coming. It's 2 or 3 years away. You know, innovations like artificial intelligence or political uncertainty and climate change being another example. And these are the things that you can do proactively to get your conversations with your boardroom on the front foot. So you can think about what these things could do or do not do for your organization and act in a proactive way. But a lot of it just comes down to bandwidth, I think. I don't know, Mark, you must have some views on this. This is your baby, right?
Yeah, well, it's certainly with, we've changed Threat Horizon quite a lot, and there's a lot of information in it this year. It's quite a beast. But we did draw up a list of priorities, and at the bottom of that list is, but actually it should be probably further up, is look after your staff. because they're going to be really busy for the next few years. There's just no doubt about
that. Really good point.
And I think that's another side of it as well, just that, you know, those people are going to be under all kinds of pressures because you're right. I think there is that expectation in some respects to do what they always did and, you know, take care of some parts of the organization that do need some curation and administration, which is fine. But then there are, as you say, Lisa, there's some that other higher level stuff too that they need to step up and take on. And that's scary because it's new. And I think, you know, people do the things they know when they get into a stressful situations, and that can leave the business wanting a bit, and that can create some tension. So I think, yeah, it's not just looking after your staff, but it's managing their relationship with the organization as well. It's a lot of hard things to get right over the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they need to be empowered to manage that relationship too. And, you know, it's important and it's incumbent on, you know, security leaders to give everybody in the security detail the opportunity to spend time with the business. And there's one piece of advice I would give to anybody. It's that, you know, just because those people work in an operational SOC buried deep in the trenches of an organization's HQ or wherever the hell it is, it doesn't mean from time to time they can't get out and see the business for what it is, because then they bring that context back to the SOC and it enriches what they do and it enriches the value, and they recognize the ramifications of just shutting that network segment down, for example. It's why things like fusion centers are becoming increasingly popular, because that knitting of security technology and business operations, you know, we're digital now, you know, organizations are digital. So, you know, our idea of just shutting a server down, I mean, 15 years ago, that was the easy option. We'll shut it down, get some breathing space, work out what's going on. You have to perform open heart surgery on patients that are still awake now. The only way you can do that and do that well is to understand the ramifications of each and every action that you take. And the only way you can do that is to look beyond the CMDB and actually look at what that means to the business. So get out and see the world. That's Paul's little bit of advice for today's podcast.
Well, I wonder if that should be the general advice for, you know, starting a new gig, is that understand the organization, I suppose. That groundwork. What are they trying to do? Do you fit in? And then once you're there,
absolutely,
what actually do they do? Because I suspect I've probably got it wrong in the description of the job. And
I've worked for a couple of organizations actually that have offered a T-minus 90 day. So, and particularly for security leaders, where they've said, look, let's get you involved in some of the early, you know, functions of what we're doing. Come to a leadership team meeting, spend a bit of time with your teams. You know, it's that little bit of pre-onboarding. And, you know, I found that really, really helpful. It gave me a bit of a picture and a vibe of how the team were feeling, what the dynamics were, you know, starting to kind of understand how, you know, scripted, choreographed meetings versus, you know, corridor conversations work. And it just helps you start to get a sense of what's going on. And it just makes that first day a little bit easier. And it's not something that everybody offers, but it, you know, if that opportunity is there, it's definitely something worth considering. Obviously, you've got to recognize that you're offboarding another organization as well, and you don't just turn off the taps. You know, we have 3 to 6 month notice periods in the UK, and we have to almost maybe in that situation be doing a little bit of both. But it's well worth it if it's offered to get that early feel for what that organization is doing. And, you know, Lisa says, you then get a really good use of that first 90 days to make a decision as to whether this is the right fit for you. Can I affect change? Can I work in this culture? Is my team broken? And then you can then work out what your year long plan is, and then what your 3 to 5 year strategy is. And all the time you're doing that, you're thinking about that in the context of you and your team, but also the business in which you serve. And as I said in the last podcast, and I'll say it again, you have to remember, without them, there's no need for us.
Yeah,
that's very true. Yeah, I think you're both right that businesses are built of technology, but they're not just bits. They're mainly bodies too. They're people. And I think people do that work. And I think that's something we need to reflect on as well. Because I don't know if Lisa, I certainly found this when I joined the ISF and to an extent in other journalism jobs, is that I hadn't quite realized how my last job had shaped me and the way I approached the world. And that was quite hard for me to get over because I'd worked for to a daily news cycle for 10 years or so. So I was expecting every day to be as busy. And it really took me a while to slow down and get to grips with the gentler pace of the ISF. I mean, it's still fairly frenetic at times, but I don't know if that's something else you guess you need to take on board when you join a new place. Where are you coming from as well?
Oh, definitely. And definitely, I think it can influence. I mean, one the thing I realized, because I was at Maersk for a reasonably, you know, long time. I was fortunate to be there for about 7.5 years. When I transitioned into a new role, it can be quite easy to be looking for the same feeling you had in your old role. And actually, you're not going to have that, are you? Because you're starting something new. And I am a good, I do, if possible, and again, it's only really, I've only really had this opportunity in the later part of my career to be able to have a reasonable break between finishing a role and starting a new one. And actually, I've found that very helpful, because you do get that time then to kind of decompress and to set your own expectations of what the new position would be, and be able to get yourself out of where you've been and to start looking a bit more forward. That's been my experience. I think it's very difficult, though. In the past, I've gone from job to job, you know, finish on a Friday, start in a new place on a Monday. That it becomes a bit more difficult, I think, then. But yeah, certainly I've experienced that. What about you, Paul?
I've always tried to put a week in between to give myself a little bit of an air gap to kind of stop and reflect. But it's interesting as I move through my career, you know, I think your point's well made, Mark. You realize kind of what you've learned in the past. One of my first jobs when I left university, I was a consultant in the business intelligence data warehousing space for 4 or 5 years, actually. And I didn't appreciate until I moved into security leadership how valuable that was, because it gave me an opportunity to experience a multitude of different vertical markets, a multitude of different corporate cultures across a multitude of different regions and countries. And as a consequence of that, I learned that I had to be highly adaptive, that it wasn't right for me to go into an organization and expect the organization to change to how I wanted, that actually there was a little bit of both, that I had to adopt my tone and my style, had to change to suit the environment that I was in, and you had to have that adaptability. But what doesn't change is at your core, you have values and you have nuances and traits that will always be there with you. It's just how you use them in the right context that I think is important. But yeah, there is something to be said if you have the luxury of that, to take that time out in between gigs to pause and reflect. And it's becoming increasingly popular. I see it quite a lot when you look at social media, where somebody says, you know, I've just finished, you know, 3 years as a global CISO in this role. I'm taking 3 months out, spend a bit of time with the kids, decompress, and then I go again. If you have the luxury of doing that, that's great. But they're very much in the minority, I would expect.
Yeah, not a lot of people get to do that.
I do think it's part of the uniqueness of cyber and information security, and the fact that certainly when I started in information security, a lot of people came to information security through different routes, and we're quite a good mixing pot of people with different skills, different approaches, different attitudes, different ways of looking at things. It's quite a good mixing pot, because, so, like I said, certainly when I was starting out, which was a billion years ago, according to my kids, is that there wasn't a direct route. Do you know what I mean? You popped out of university directly into site. Not in those days. You did other things, and all of those other things gave you a sense of perspective. So I totally resonate with what you said, Paul, around bringing different skills with you. And I think that's what makes cyber and information security such a unique community and environment to work in, is because it welcomes people from every walk of life, almost. We've all got something to contribute.
It does, and I think we're starting to recognize this now as a community of practice. And, you know, we are reaching out screaming for this. You know, cybersecurity can be seen to be quite an academic discipline that requires a certain set of skills. But as cyber and technology has knitted into business, we now realize that the things that are holding us back are, you know, our business analytical skills need a bit of work. Our ability to communicate with business stakeholders needs a bit of work. You know, that broader creative mindset, you know, needs to be injected into cybersecurity so we can be seen to be innovative. And to me, that signals one thing, a really valuable thing, is our industry is changing, and it's changing rapidly. So the next generation of people coming into our industry, whereas we have lucked out in having the opportunity to learn different skills and experience different things as we've gone through our career, that's almost becoming a mandate now. you know, I go to universities and I love doing this, and you know, talking to the students about their hopes and dreams, and when they all say they want to be pen testers, a little bit of me dies inside, because actually the industry needs a massive breadth of skills for cybersecurity to flourish. And, you know, if there's one thing that the industry has got to do, and it's beyond the remit of the ISF, but we can have these conversations and effect change, is recognize that blend and diversity of skills is what will make us successful in the future. And we need to be encouraging those new people coming into the industry to try new different things. Let them go out and second for 6 months and bring them back. Let them experience that, because all of that enriches what it is I think we're trying to do. So the career pathways and your trajectory through cybersecurity, I think they're going to be vastly different from where they were. You don't have to be a techie to come into this industry, and we have to make sure that message is loud and clear.
Yeah, I think that's true, because I think if you get the same sort of people, you get the same sort of output.
Totally, yes. Totally agree with you.
And if you get that diverse point of view and people with different skills, then it's going to change, and it kind of has to change. So yeah, I think that the two go hand in hand.
Absolutely. It's not all about STEM. Is it?
No.
As somebody who has a very poor qualification in math, and that was it at a GCSE level and not any further. It's not all about STEM.
No, definitely not. Final point then. I just wonder, we've gone on quite a bit about the No. It's been great, but. I wonder if we can finish off with a piece of advice from both of you. What should you not do during those first few weeks, months? Is there a thing that you think, don't suddenly try and triple the budget and kick the door of the boardroom in and say, give me all your money kind of thing? I just don't give you a moment or two to think. But Paul, Lisa, what should you not do in those early days?
I'll let you go first, Lise.
Gee, thanks.
You're welcome.
I think for me, it's really dependent on the organization and why you are employed, especially in a senior position. Because in some organizations, actually, you may need to go into the board, not kick it down, but you may need to go into the board and say, listen, for where you want to be as an organization, the security team are grossly under-resourced to be able to deliver that securely to you. So you may need to go in and have those conversations. I think generally, I do think it's important you make up your own mind. You've been employed for your expertise and your decision making and your ability to strategize and understand a good route for the security team or the technology team to be able to follow to drive the business objectives. Remember that. Don't be pushed into taking lots and lots of disruptive action just because you're in a 30-day plan. And you need to, we're not football managers, although I'm sure football managers would also disagree that they should be pushed into seeing very, very quick turnaround in results. Again, depending on the organization, it might not be possible to have a quick result in 30 days. And that's okay, as long as you communicate that, I think. That would be my bit rambly.
I'm pretty much on point with that as well. The thing I was going to say is resist the temptation to boil the ocean. There's no cookie cutter approach to delivering cybersecurity strategy in any organization. You've got to understand the cultural context. You've got to understand their motivators, what makes it tick, and get a bit of the history before you start to make snap decisions. Quick wins are great, but if all you're doing is quick wins, you're not effecting strategic change. So you've got to get that balance absolutely right. But have an open mind. You're going to hit that we've always done it this way thing, which is a sentence that needs to be banned in industry and business, I think, because it's the thing that holds a lot of organizations back when they get kind of stuck in a rut. But also you can exploit the IMU. So if you see something that looks like a bit of a smoking gun, you can exploit that honeymoon naivety by asking the question that everybody else is scared to ask. Because, they know that there's a skeleton in that closet. Ask what's in the closet, open the door, and then deal with it. There's a point in time when you're not going to be able to do that, but exploit that opportunity. But in summary, don't try and boil the ocean. Don't persist in quick wins, and just think before you go in all guns blazing. No two companies are created the same.
Okay, excellent. So it's no wonder that people think InfoSec is interesting then. We've got not football managers. Don't ball the ocean. Skeletons in closets, smoking guns. It's all good. Excellent stuff. Thank you. Thanks to Paul. Thanks to Lisa. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Tell your colleagues. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audioboom, where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.
Let's go to work.